fanboy.
Part-time fanboy doing my thing.
Hello?
Hello.
How you doing?
How are you, Ian?
Good, man. Good to be back.
Good to have you back. Back at Part-Time Fanboy. So, I guess let's talk about what, you know, the elephant in the room. Batman, The Dark Knight Returns Part 1, because I know that you're going to have an opinion on it, because this was your first comic book that you ever read, right?
This was pretty much, I think I'd only owned like Captain America with like the Wolfman guest starring in it.
Yeah.
And I literally had, you know, maybe five or six, I think, comics to my name. This is how I remember it, of course. I had a couple Aquaman comics. I basically was so new. And I met this guy, I think this guy's name was Bob, and he, I forgot his last name, but he was in the local community theater. You know, I would pretty much, when I was that age, I would always do shows in Jersey. And I somehow just, you know, you mentioned you collect comics, you read comics, and there's sometimes someone there who's older, who's like a legitimate collector, and who will tell you, hey, you know, that's great, I collect comics too, and here's some stuff, you know, I could recommend. So he recommends The Watchmen to me.
Wait, how old were you at this point?
I was young, man. I don't even think I was in middle school. I might have been still in grade school.
That's a pretty screwed up recommendation for a like a middle schooler, don't you think? The Watchmen?
Well, yeah, that's the great thing about doing community theater is you grow up way too quick. You see
yeah,
you know,
definitely.
You see stuff you shouldn't see, you read stuff you shouldn't read, and you're interacting with people that are much older than you and are incredibly, you know, you just see stuff, you know, you see girls making out with dudes backstage when you know you haven't even gone through puberty. And then you know you read Watchmen, and then because of that, Dark Knight Returns was there, and I always remember seeing the book because it was the cover, it was the collected cover where Batman is standing in the city of Gotham on the cover.
Oh, yeah, yeah, I remember that.
You know, in the clock tower, which makes a great appearance in the animated movie. The clock tower is there, and he's sort of just standing behind it, and it took this two trips to the store to just me for just pick it up, and I picked it up and that was it. And once I read that, I was like just fanboy for life, you know.
So which issue did you pick up first? You picked up the first issue or
no? It was the whole thing.
Oh, the trade. Okay,
it was the first printing of the trade paperback.
Yeah. And that was a time where comics were not really being collected into trade paperbacks.
Like exactly,
it was really hard to find stuff. Not like today.
Yeah, it was great. And I think later on, as you know, I got in, of course, to reading the Overstreet guides, and I remember one way to tell if the trade was a first printing was the inset pages that had bats on them. I think there was like these great pages that had bats on them, and I remember going back and being like, oh, I have the first trade run of a trade paperback of this book. And
that's great.
It became more special later, of course, but you know, this is the, to me, like, I don't know, there's so much to talk about as far as production with voices and the art that they did on the movie and the overall things they chose to keep in and keep out, but there's also the whole fanboy side. Like, to me, I wasn't expecting a disaster. I wasn't expecting really anything, but anticipation for something was so high going into this.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, the way it even came about was, I think I told you yesterday, I'm like, oh, you know, maybe Christian can hook up some screening because he might have the inside track. And I didn't even ask you.
Yeah.
Because I got home and I had an email from Alfred. It literally was an email from Alfred Pennyworth. and it was my buddy basically got into the screening, which was in Beverly Hills at the Paley Center for Media. But DC Comics Home Entertainment created a Gmail account that was Alfred Pennyworth, and Alfred was emailing everyone inviting you to the screening.
Oh, so, that's great.
that was a total geek out thing. And all of a sudden, my buddy's like, hey, you know, we can get into this. And I don't know. Like, I guess it's just a certain amount of people were super excited. Were you super excited for this to be coming out?
I was not super excited. I mean, I pre-ordered it on Amazon, like I do with all the DC. I've bought all the DC animated movies. Like, okay. I'm a big fan at going back to, you know, the original Batman animated series onto, you know, the Superman animated series and onto, you know, Justice League, you know, what they're doing, the straight to home release DVD releases. And, you know, now I'm a big fan of the Young Justice cartoon. And I actually really like the Green Lantern animated series. I've been a big fan of, like, the DC animated universe. The Teen Titans cartoon, I absolutely loved that show. I just thought it was a refreshing take on everything, and even the Legion of Superheroes cartoon. So I'm a big fan of, I'm a DC fan. I mean, when I was a teenager, I was a big Marvel fan, but I'm a DC fan right now, not of so much of the actual comic books themselves, but of the characters, you know what I'm saying? So, but for this, I mean, the straight to video releases of the animated movies, they've gone back and forth, you know, for me. So I wasn't like, some of them, I don't know if any one of them has really knocked it out of the park for me. Some of them I've liked more than others, and some of them have been really weak, like really weak for me. But there's something about me, and I know people probably think I'm a sucker for actually buying media these days or whatever, but I will actually go on to, as soon as I find out that you're doing something, I go on Amazon and I pre-order it, no questions asked, because I know that there's going to be something in it that I like. And
did you do that? Did you do that with this one?
Oh, yeah. I pre-ordered it right away, and I was expecting it to come out. And I am a big fan of The Dark Knight Returns, the original comic series. Unlike you, it was not, like, my first experience. But right. I would say that it was my first sort of maybe grown-up experience as far as what I was reading. Was beyond my maturity level. You know what I'm saying? I think that when this came out, there were a lot of news stories coming out about it, like in the news. And so I was probably 7th or 8th grade, something like that. And the stories were coming out, and I had just discovered a comic book shop in New Jersey at the Bergen Mall. And I did not get the first issue. I got the second issue. And I was lost. I was completely lost.
Oh, yeah.
Like, I was, I did not know what was going on. I don't think I even grasped the concept that this was supposed to be like Batman in the future. I mean, I think I did, like, I knew, but I, you know, what are you, like 12, 13 at that age? Like,
yeah.
You don't get the concept of, like, retired, you know, of, like, I'm old. And the art, too, was, now I'm an adult and, you know, I think I have a unique appreciation for art, you know, a more mature appreciation, I would say, not unique. But at that time, you know, I did not get what I was looking at. I was like, this is ugly. Like, I don't get it. It's so dark and everything. And now I think it's pure genius. I mean, I really think it's one of the better, you know, just the panel work and the storytelling and just the intensity that builds up through the work. And so I read that second issue, and I don't think I picked up another one after that because I didn't get it. You know, I just didn't get it. But then a couple years may have gone by, and I picked up a trade, and I don't know if I was more mature or I don't know what it was. I think I must have been a sophomore in high school, and I picked it up. And the reason that I remember I was a sophomore was because, I don't know about you, but I got made, you know, I was constantly teased in high school, like first 2 years of high school, I was made fun of, picked on, blah blah blah, you know. And it was even worse because I read comic books, you know what I'm saying? So and the reason that I remember that is because I was reading the trade paperback and really digging it, like being like, what is going on? So I don't know, whatever happens between seventh grade and whatever maturity level happens between seventh grade and sophomore in high school, there's definitely a jump because I was getting it. I don't think I understood all the undertones, but I remember reading it and some kid was making fun of me because I was into Batman. And I was like, you know, Batman's cool. He uses a machine gun. And they were like, Batman doesn't use a machine. Batman's gay or whatever, you know, right, pardon the expression. And I was like, so the next day I brought in that book and I showed him the page where the mutants had kidnapped the kid. And he's got, and he grabs the big chain machine gun. And he says like, and the guy says, believe me, I'll kill you. Like one of the best sequences in the book, in my opinion. And Batman like blows him away, and he's like, and they stopped making fun of me. They left me alone after that. They couldn't put the book down. They could not put the book down. And that's a true story. That actually happened. So they were like, oh, Batman's awesome. So for me, I don't think The Dark Knight Returns was as pivotal in my comic experience as for you, but it was definitely a big moment. So
I mean, that whole day at work, before I got the email from Alfred, I was basically, I'm like, does anyone care here? Like, I was making a big deal with it. You know, I'm like, hey, I think I'm gonna try to see this. So I got the email the next day, or the next week or so. I had to wait, and I'm like, oh man, I cannot wait to go to this thing. And my buddy, Adam Gertler, was the one who got the tickets. He, you know, he's like, look, man, I couldn't bring a girl, one of my girlfriends, to this because they don't understand the gravity of it. So me and him are the same age. We actually graduated Syracuse the same time, so we read the book at the same time. So our love for it is very similar. So like, we hit some Chinese place, got all like, went to happy hour, you know, had a few drinks, and we're like ready to do this. But that day I was like, people, don't you understand what's going on tonight? I'm going to see The Dark Knight Returns. And like, even some of the comic book geeks in the office were just like, oh, I'll get it next year when they come out, blah, blah, blah. I'm going into a theater, and there's going to be a panel. They're all going to be there. The producer, awesome. The director, everyone's going to be there. And I had a great time, man. So where do you want to start with this? This is like, we could dissect this from a million angles. I started listening to the Kevin Smith stuff, and you know, he does a great job with everything, but I find him to be, you know, overly verbose, and I actually couldn't even finish the podcast, and it really didn't sway my opinion one way or another. But,
Well, I think they were just talking factually, you know what I'm saying, like breaking it down. And for anyone out there who doesn't know, obviously, like, Kevin Smith does a podcast called Fat Man on Batman, and I listened to his breakdown of it, and recommended that you did too, because I actually thought he broke it down pretty well. Like, they were doing commentary practically while they were watching.
Right, commentary was what I was listening to. And for me, this movie, it really does stand alone, but at the same time, like, the way I watched Watchmen, for instance, to me, the Watchmen movie was an homage, you know, and I look at it as an homage. I don't think I could ever look at the Watchmen movie and be like, this is better than the comic, or no, it's the best movie I've ever seen.
I hate the Watchmen. I hate it.
Well, there's a similarity I had with this, in that this, to me, is never gonna be the same as reading the book. However, when the lights went up and the movie ended, I was like, God, that was really good. And I felt like it fulfilled. I felt like, story wise, just as a movie going experience, I felt like it was a fulfilling story, and I can't wait to see the next one. There's definite things in there, if I could begin, where I was waning. And honestly, in the beginning, when it got to the point where they did that dual helicopter scene where Two-Face is ascending, you know, into Gotham with two helicopters, and he's just causing a shitstorm. And it was a nice action sequence. Do you remember which one I'm talking about?
Yeah, but you're skipping, like, way ahead.
I'm only jumping ahead because, in general, it kind of puts a framework on how I was seeing the movie. And once I got to the action sequence like that, I was like, oh, if this movie continues and it's total crap, at least I could cherish this little action scene they've put together here. And that was before, I think, some of the fights that came later, which I really enjoyed, with one-on-one with Batman. And but all in all, I gave it a thumbs up. I mean, did you give it a thumbs up, or
I give it a thumbs up, but there's a lot of things that, you know, I would have approached differently. And from the beginning, I remember watching the very beginning of the movie, and right. I mean, you know, we have to admit, like, these things, I mean, they're given pretty decent sized budgets, but they can't compare to, like, say, something coming out of, like, maybe Tokyo, or I don't know if it's that the Tokyo budget is bigger or better, or maybe that they just pay their people less. I don't know. You know, I don't know.
Either, as far as I know, you mean with, like, Tokyo, like, anime?
Yeah, anime. Yeah, oh, yeah.
Right. I think as far from what I've seen in Japan when I was there, and also outside of Japan, especially watching the Mononoke type stuff and the behind the scenes on those, is they live. Those people live and sleep at their desks, and they get ramen.
Oh, Jesus!
You know what I mean? They literally cook ramen in the studio, and it's just total labor of love. No bullshit, just the movie. And but the, you know, if you're heading towards like the frame rate or the quality of the animation, it's at a much, much higher level. And that's something I noticed right away too, where I'm like, okay, I'm gonna have to just adjust and be okay with this kind of you know, it felt like it's exported animation, like it's sent over to some house. I think they called it overseas in the talkback. And immediately I let it go, because I'm like, okay, I understand.
Well, no, for me, it's not even the way that it looked. The movie opens up with, like, Bruce Wayne, and he is in a car race, right? He's at the, like, you know, whatever, Monte Carlo, or, you know, but it's Gotham. He's at a race car. He's race car driving, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
and the thing is I had gotten a Blu-ray maybe like 2 or 3 weeks ago of a movie called Redline, an anime, and I haven't been able to finish watching it. I watched the first half hour, but it's about cars and racing cars, like in some crazy future.
Yeah, that's where the preview to that is nuts, because it's like, Redline!
Yeah, it's pretty amazing. But just, so I had been, like, so when Dark Knight Returns starts and he's in a car race, like, I felt that car race, maybe I was unfairly comparing it to Redline, or even, you know, there's a cartoon on I think Disney XD called Motor City or Motocross, or I can't remember what it's called. I felt like they were setting the tone off a little weak, because I felt that the animation was not very powerful in that sequence, you know?
You're right. The most powerful parts for me were when they were doing that camera up from where the pedals were in the car to Bruce Wayne, and you got to see the silhouette of the bat ears when he was... You know, and I think they... Throughout the movie, I think they picked their shots like that, where they're framing this kind of, I guess, lower, for lack of a better term, just a lower quality animation, but then they get very detailed at certain points, and it becomes quite abstract in some places because of that style and the way it's kind of put together. Yeah.
It's really interesting to me, because, I mean, it really seemed like... you know, it's very much must be like a production TV show, where it's like, okay, this episode we're going to devote more cash to, this episode a little less cash, you know, this episode, because the writing on this episode or the set pieces in this episode, it seems like during the course of this animated movie and maybe other DC animated movies I've noticed, where one sequence like really stands out, you can tell like it was like really hands-on, and it seemed like maybe more of the budget or the time was devoted to that. And the opening car chase kind of like let me down a little bit, because I don't feel like you got the sense of motion, the sense of danger, the sense of like speed that you could have gotten from a car race.
I agree. And I think even if you look at the backgrounds of what they were doing, it was very sparse.
Yeah.
It was just super sparse. And you didn't have that rush, which comes from just more frames of animation and more... you know, more detail there. I guess, like I said, there were certain things where you just let go, and quite frankly, a lot of the book, you know, I only remember just shadows of the book. I remember bits and pieces. So kind of what I was seeing here was almost like I was watching it for the first time, and I'm like, okay, they're starting with this kind of very sparse, abstract look, and I enjoy that look in my comics anyway.
Yeah,
So, but I definitely hear what you're saying, because I did have the thought, like, ooh, I hope it's not this rough the whole entire
Yeah, and I feel like that was a big mistake to open it up like that. Like, if you're going to open a car chase, you know, open up with a car race, excuse me, not a car chase, you've got to make it dramatic. And especially that moment where, well, I mean, let's get to it. They dropped the inner monologue pretty much for the whole thing. And that was a big jarring thing for me, because there's so many lines in that inner monologue that, you know, it's really funny that you said you couldn't remember the book, but it was interesting while I was watching this. I mean, I must have read this. I haven't read The Dark Knight Returns in a long time, but there must have been a period where I've read that, because I remembered panels. Like, I remembered lines of dialogue as I was going through this movie. And I was like, you know, I mean, just that very first bit where he's in the car race, you know, and I can't remember if that was in the book, but something like it. But, and there's that line where it's like, this would be a very good way to die. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, they got rid of that? Like, he couldn't even say it or mumble it? Like, that line is so powerful, because it just, it reads, it shows you how much of the character, how much character there, it just displays so much of Bruce Wayne's character at that point, like where he's like, he's almost ready to just like be like, my life is over, you know, Batman is gone, I've retired, you know.
I agree. And in this version of it, he was basically, from what I could gather, he was done being Batman, and he was a drunk, and he was a drunk.
Yeah.
Because in that monologue, or in the voiceover in the comic, he talks about having angina, doesn't he?
Oh, I don't remember. I don't remember.
And that's what my buddy Adam was saying. He has like heart issues.
Oh yeah, Okay,
and
yeah.
I don't think we got any of that. He was basically Batman retired.
Yeah.
And he liked to drink.
Yeah.
He took up and that was really it. I don't think there was that that scene with Commissioner Gordon, which I thought was kind of cool, to set the stage. You know, kind of fills in a lot of that as far as the background of what Bruce has been doing.
Sure.
But there isn't that kind of gripping, like, he's got a death wish, and it didn't seem as extreme.
Yeah, right? It definitely didn't. Yeah. And, well, there was a lot of the extreme stuff pulled back, and I still can't get, you know, because Kevin Smith, you know, in his podcast, he basically said, like, oh, maybe they ran it and it didn't work. And I just kind of don't buy that. Like, I it could work. I mean, a really good filmmaker would make something like that work. I mean, obviously, voiceover is supposed to be like the quote-unquote death of a screenplay. Like, you're not supposed to, but...
Sure.
The whole thing with The Dark Knight Returns is, like, the book is that it's very noir. You know what I mean? It's got its roots based in, like, the old detective novels or even the old movies, you know, where the black and white movies where you would have the voiceover from the detective, or, you know, even what some people may consider was a bad use of it, like in the original cut of Blade Runner. You know what I'm saying? And I feel like leaving that out was a big mistake, but... You know, very much like as soon as I realized that that's what was going on, I was able to put it in the background and go, okay, all right, this was the first big mistake for me, but I'm just gonna go with it. You know,
it's a big thing. I didn't even remember the voiceover part of the book, because every comic has that. Batman's always talking to himself.
Yeah, I guess.
And the fact that it wasn't there, movie wise. It could be, you know, the reasons that things were not in this thing, to me, I was like, you know, even the decision to make this movie, the director said, you know, it just came across my desk. So there's executives making these decisions about which movies to make. And then once you get in there, did the writer take out the voiceover? I mean, you had the perfect voiceover artist to do that voiceover. And Peter Weller would have been great. Or was it something where, you know, they did it on year one, correct?
Yeah.
And I know some people had said to me it slowed down the movie for them. And I think it's a choice. I've heard a lot of filmmakers just kind of talk about voiceover, not voiceover. But if it was in this movie, I think it would have been fine. I don't completely miss it, but it is a big, it's a big thing, right?
Yeah. Well, to me, it's a very big decision too, or a very big mistake, because like you said, they had Peter Weller, who pulled it out as far as I'm concerned, and has that sort of depth of tone and that deepness of quality of voice that, you know, that background inner monologue would really work very powerfully. You know what I'm saying? I mean, I know there's a lot of people who, you know, wish that the voice from the animated series had done it.
Conway?
Yeah. Kevin Conroy. Yeah, Kevin Conroy. Sorry. Yeah, and I actually kind of wish he had done that too.
Oh, absolutely.
Because you know he could have modified his... He's enough of a talent to where he could have modified his voice to sound older or more gravelly or whatever.
Absolutely.
But they did, I mean, if they were going to substitute, Peter Weller was a good choice, and I just feel like so much stuff, if you'd never read The Dark Knight Returns, so much pathos was kind of like left off the table, you know, on the table, you know. But like I said, once I realized that this was what was going to happen, I had to curb my inner rabid fanboy and be like, all right, dude, just chill out, because you've got about an hour and a half to go. And if you're just going to freak out and be like, I hate this, based off of there's no voiceover, you know, just see what they do. Because as you know, like in screenwriting, again, you know, it's show, not say, you know, show what the character is doing, not so maybe they just embraced that that holy testament of screenwriting and saying, like, we're not going to have him say what he's doing, we're going to show it. And they pulled that out as well. I mean, I've kind of gone off on them a little for not using the voiceover, but in the end they did make it work, you know. I mean, it worked without it.
Absolutely.
They were able to make it work. So I would have much rather liked it there, but and just, you know, to nitpick again, the other thing that kind of bothered me was the palette. You know what I'm saying?
It was very muted.
It's not, I don't think it was so muted. I think it was just, you had a lot of like yellows in there and lighter color spectrum than the actual comic book, which I thought I wish that they had. I mean, it's basically a storyboard, right? I mean, you don't necessarily want them to do exactly what they did in the book, but the thing that's so super effective about The Dark Knight Returns is the palette of the colors. Everything's dark, gray, scary, creepy. Yeah. And I feel like that was something else that was lacking in this, was that it was not... I didn't get the sense of doom and foreboding that just...
No, it was pretty, I guess, muted wasn't the right word, but it felt like it was... It just seemed like it wasn't super dark. I thought some of the animated TV show episodes were darker.
Yeah, absolutely.
I thought, you know what I thought was really dark was Mask of the Phantasm was even a little darker, especially with the shadowing.
Yeah.
I did like some of the color, but overall it did have a minimalistic feel to it to me.
Yeah.
You know, it really did.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I have to say, I mean, it took me 20 minutes to get over the initial disappointment of how things were going, but that's happened to me before. There was another release that they did called Superman versus the Elite, and I don't know how well that one did or how highly regarded it is. I'm actually looking at a review for it on Amazon. It seems like a lot of people gave it decent reviews. But I remember with Superman versus the Elite, I don't know if what was going on, but I literally stopped it like two times and had to go back to it to start watching it over again.
Wow.
And then, and then, you know, I was like, well, I bought this, I better keep watching it. You know, so I don't know what that says about that, but I know that because it's DC and because I like these characters, I was definitely giving it much more of a pass than I would have if it had been like a regular movie, you know, with a character that I'd never heard of before.
Absolutely.
You know, not that I would have shut it off, but, well, that's the thing, is probably there's maybe some of the reasons that I had had problems with it were because I'm such a fanboy, you know, not because of the actual work itself, you know. I'm willing to admit that part of my disappointment is not because of the expertise of what's going on in the film, but because of the attachments that I have to the work. You understand what I'm saying?
Well, sure. And that's why like making those adjustments you're talking about, I think it took me a while too to be like, I'm watching The Dark Knight Returns here, and yeah. And that's why I was just taking, I guess, enjoyment in these little small scenes that they had, you know, before the bigger movie had actually been carried out, before the plot was really on its way. There were, you know, those scenes with Two-Face or whatever, where I was like, oh wow, that, you know, they did a good job with that. I like this and that, and I'm like, okay, at least it's a small victory. So I had to do that adjusting too, and I felt like it took me at least a half an hour to really get into it and accept it as a movie form,
yeah,
of this book I love. And
yeah,
you know, by the time it ended, I was like, wow, that really felt cool. I was getting more and more into it. I really wish I could have just stayed and watched the second part. I mean,
yeah. Well, I feel like when the second part comes out, I'm not even going to watch it until I rewatch the... Like, I want to do a double feature, like maybe sit my wife down, you know.
Oh, dude, let me know when you do that so I can join you and your wife.
I want to do that. And then maybe we could do Batman Year One after it. You know what I'm saying?
Oh, dude, like, I'll bring my sleeping bag as well.
That'd be awesome. No, but I mean, I just... That's the thing, is I completely agree with you in the fact that I feel like as it went on, I felt better about it. Like, as it went on, I was okay. As it went on, I was like, oh, okay. Like how much, they kept a lot in there. They kept a lot in there. And,
oh, yeah.
And
yeah.
Just the gang members alone, you know, were just, their appearance was spot on, you know. So they mm-hmm. were very faithful to the original book in a lot of ways. It's just there's a part of me that's like, couldn't you be a little more faithful? You know, I don't know. But like, what big sequence in your mind kind of stuck out in your head? Because
I think it was that first. Well, actually, I gotta say, leading up to the first fight between Batman and the head mutant.
Yeah.
Leading up to that, I thought this movie executed the whole rookie cop and veteran cop and rookie cop first seeing Batman. They did that better than the Nolan movie, I thought.
Oh yeah, yeah.
And I really just loved how that went down, because the rookie cop actually, you know, obviously, you know, we're spoiling this thing, but the rookie cop was involved in the combat. Whereas in the Nolan movie, he basically, you know, shined a light on him, and it was very tame that way.
Yeah.
And the whole kind of – that whole just – you know, the moment that was there was great. And I thought this movie did a lot of things better than the Nolan pictures, actually.
Oh, yeah. No, I mean – but Nolan heavily ripped them off. I mean, ripped off the dark
–
you know, like a lot of Frank Miller stuff.
But I love that, you know. And the rookie – and, you know, these are scenes that are really Batman lore. And do them multiple times. You'll have different artists do different takes on them, but we love seeing them reenacted, and they've become almost like Batman morality plays, or, you know. So that was well done. I love the Two-Face scene with the two helicopters, and, you know, Batman launching. At one point, he launches a freaking high wire cable across the two buildings, and he runs across it. And for one second, I'm like, nah. And then I was like, okay. And he's doing it, and we were laughing, the audience was laughing and having a real good time. I love the detail when he's with the gun, you know, he's waiting for the helicopters to come, and he's just cracking his freaking back, because he's like, you know, it's like, fuck, you know, you could just see how old he is. And yeah, once it got to that first fight with the head mutant, they did put a nice level of detail into those fight scenes. And having trained martial arts since high school and boxing and kung fu, like, they really did some nice stuff with the hand-to-hand combat.
Yeah. Oh, no, I absolutely 100% agree with you that the two fight sequences were just, you know, brilliantly done. And it's that those were two of the standouts for me, you know, was the first one where Batman, you know, kind of barely makes it out alive, right? And, you know, and then the follow-up, right? I mean, that's the thing. It's so funny that you mentioned the rookie cop and the veteran cop, because that was one of those scenes where I just started having flashbacks to the book, you know, where I was literally like, oh my God, I remember that line. Oh my God, I remember the sequence. You know, I just thought, oh wow, they're doing a pretty good job of staying faithful to it. And I think that might have been sort of the sequence where he finally kind of decides that he's going to become Batman again, where he's feeling like sort of tortured and like, you know, what do I do? And like, to me, that sequence, that the voiceover was, I've sorely missed it, but I think they did an okay job with it, because that scene in the book, in the Dark Knight Returns comic, just is like one of the most, it just sticks in my head the most out of almost any other comic book, where it's like, you cannot deny me, you know, you cannot stop me, you're like a rusty trap trying to hold me back, or something like that, where, you know, basically the inner persona of whatever, the Bat or Batman, is like saying, like, you've tried to hold me back and you can't do it anymore, you know.
Right.
And I thought, even without the voiceover, they kind of managed to pull that out, and that's when it kind of started to get moving for me, which when Batman shows up. And but it's, they made an interesting choice with the when Batman first shows up in the city, because from what I remember of the book, you didn't necessarily know it was Batman. You never saw him. You know what I mean? And then the news reports were saying, like, reports of a man dressed as a bat, you know?
Right,
so it was
right.
Very much, and maybe they just made that decision, like, oh, we got to show Batman. It's a Batman movie. We can't not show Batman. But still, I mean, for what they did, you know, it was pretty well executed, I think. I mean, yeah, they in my opinion, they didn't do anything horribly wrong. And I will be picking up the second one. I mean, you know.
Oh, yeah. Can't wait for that. I'm going to try to get into that screening.
Yeah,
too.
Well, if they have a screening, you got to figure it out. Because I really thought, by the end, you know, when the Joker's like, you know, Batman, it's just like, oh, it's on. And they've definitely, it's interesting because I feel like in splitting it up, they've kind of tried to do a Kill Bill part one and part two sort of thing. And I remember seeing Kill Bill in the theater, the first one, and just being blown away by it, and being like the climax and everything, and just being like, oh my God, this is amazing. And then, you know, like, they made a movie just for me. Like, I loved the Kill Bill part one. And when I went to see Kill Bill part two, I was like, meh, you know, like he had made two separate films, where it feels like The Dark Knight Returns, to me, if they do it right, it seems like it's just building up.
Oh, yeah.
So that the second half, I mean, is just going to be outstanding. I mean, maybe, I hope my expectations aren't too high, but it feels like they've made part one and part two, like, they've made it as a whole film, as opposed to, like, this is one movie, and then this is another movie. Because, because like I've said, I mean, they've done a really good job of sort of starts off kind of weak and then keeps going and is going and is going up and up and up. You know what I'm saying?
And exactly. And that's how the night went. I was like, wait, this is getting better. And then all of a sudden, halfway through the movie, I'm like, wow, this is really good.
Yeah.
And then it
yeah.
got to the end. I'm like, man, that was great.
Yeah.
That was great. And then, you know, I felt like they didn't wrong the fans. They did the fans right.
Yeah.
They did the source material right.
Yeah.
And I think that's because, as in the talkback, everyone, you know, loves that book. And even Peter Weller, because of his work in the RoboCop movies, you know, he knows Frank Miller.
Yeah,
so
that's right.
There's a lot of interesting tie-ins to the actual original subject matter and the actual movie. And across the board, I mean, no one wanted to mess this up. And I think everyone just went ahead with the right footing, and it's just created a nice piece that doesn't it feels right. And man, the second one, I'm just like, oh, do they have to? I guess they want to hit Christmas now, right? And then sell the other one separately next year, and then do a double package. And it's like, would you box the both together, give me some book in there, and I'll buy the whatever the deluxe, you know, ice cream coated version. I don't, you know, I really am gonna put it on my shelf, and I can't wait.
Yeah, the release timing does seem kind of odd, because I would think, why wouldn't you do part two like right before Christmas? Because that's going to be huge. I mean, I know that this one has been apparently doing really well with the sales, I think.
Oh, really? I don't know. I guess they just looked at it and were like, all right, if we're going to do this right, we have to do two parts. And, you know, if they're going to make a little more change off it, that's good for them. But a lot of people I know are just going to wait for, you know, for both parts. And
oh, really?
Yeah, I'm waiting for both parts. I'm not going to get anything yet. I don't, like you said, I don't want to watch part one without part two. I want to watch the whole thing. And, man, because towards the end, I was like yelling out loud in the theater when Batman does, he basically does, if you ever watch Ken Shamrock do his mixed martial arts, his pancrase fights from Japan, which was basically no holds barred fighting. There was no punches. It was open hand slaps, but it was a lot of leg locks. That leg lock that Batman puts on the mutant at the end is, I mean, technique-wise was like flawless. I mean, they didn't fake any of that fighting, and it's to say that about an animation is cool, because it just brings the level up so much. And the fight kept going, both fights, and I'm like, I wish someone would show this level of martial arts on Batman in the movies. And to me, only the Michael Keaton scene in the alleyway when he fights the guy with the double swords that Tim Burton directed, that's the only movie that sort of hints at that. Whereas, man, with freaking the Bane fight, the Bale was just swinging. It looked like a barroom brawl.
Yeah,
and this, the fighting in this movie is nothing to shirk at, man. It had everything as far as what a professional fight would be, on top of the, you know, the story arc and implications of The Dark Knight Returns. So I was loving it, man. I loved the fight action. I loved it.
Yeah. I mean, you would know better than I, but that's one of the big things that, well, I liked about the book, and this is very much how he decides he's going to go brawl with the mutant leader, and once he's in it, he's like, whoa, this guy's much younger than me and much more savage, and I need to, after he gets basically decimated, it's like, I need to think this through, you know? And that's one of the brilliant pieces of Frank Miller's writing in the original book, is, you know, where they have the final showdown in a mud pool, you know, and that brilliant line of dialogue, and he says it in the movie, he says it to the mutant leader, where it's like, in the mud, everybody's slow, you know, so there's, right, you have no advantage over me, you know, so, that, and that's the thing that I think was missing in the last Nolan flick, which is the part where it's like Batman thinks things through, you know, and that's the biggest problem I had with the Bane fight in the dark, where he's just like punching Bane, and at no point does he realize, hey, the guy's got something over his mouth, you know what I mean? it's just like, at no point does Batman ever, to me, in that last movie, think things through really well, whereas in this, you know, and a lot of it obviously doing with Frank Miller's original script, Batman's a thinker. He thinks in strategy terms. He's thinking like 10 steps ahead of you, you know what I mean? And and it took him a while in the book and in this to get back to that. In the beginning, he was just full of anger and vengeance, and he didn't think with his head, and he was able to pull it out at the last minute because Robin came and saved his butt, but you know, and in the end, his thinking wins out.
Exactly. And so what did you think about the supporting characters like Commissioner Gordon, Robin, and Alfred, etc.?
Well, I thought everyone did a really great job. I mean, all the voice work was really fantastic. I really did enjoy Commissioner Gordon a lot. Like, whoever, and I think it was the guy from Dark Shadows.
That's
can't remember his name, but I never watched Dark Shadows. I was too young, and I never caught it. But I know that I really felt that his voice work was really well done, and I really kind of connected with Gordon as well as you could, like in an animated show. And I did like the characterization of Carrie Kelly, you know, the
she was great.
Robin.
Yeah, I thought she was awesome.
I think they did a really good job. You know, I do feel like in the book you get a little bit more of the in over her head feel. Like in this, mm-hmm. she's a little more headstrong, but you know, that's fine. And I did like the moment where he's, you know, and I liked it in the book. That's the thing. That's why it's so hard for me. Can I separate the book from this thing? Because the writing in the book, there's so much stuff that mirrors there. But the sequence where he's all beat up and he's like, "My name is Bruce," and you know, Alfred's like, "Hey, what are you doing?" You know, and right. and he's like, you know, Robin comes to the back. She's coming with us to the back. Like they executed that very well in the animated movie. But they had a really good guidebook. You know what I'm saying?
Oh yeah.
Yeah. So I just think, yeah. So I can't wait for the and you know, like I said, I bought the first one. I was not gonna wait, you know. And part of the thing that ticked me off is I was going to Hawaii, or we would have done this podcast last weekend. Right. And I was hoping that Amazon was gonna get me the shipment before I had to go to Hawaii, but it turns out they shipped it to me while I was in Hawaii, because the thing came out on Tuesday. And, you know, they shipped it out, but, you know, it didn't get to me till after I left for my weekend, and I was hoping I could watch it on the plane. And, you know, so I was, like, waiting that whole weekend, like, oh, my gosh, it's probably sitting in my mailbox right now, and I can't watch it. And I know it was available on iTunes a week before the DVD release, but I'm not into that. I'm not into buying the digital files. I like having the discs.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that was interesting that they released it early. They had a whole thing at the, you know, premiere where the guy in charge of home entertainment was there, and they have a whole spiel. Like, they have a marketing spiel they've come up with where it's like, it's available on blah blah, and like there's literally, you know, there's a gazillion ways to get the movie now, and I don't even know their spiel, thank God.
Yeah.
But I was actually kind of sickened by it that they took time to come up with, you know, wait, you know, here's all the, you know, it used to be like, go to the store and buy it.
Now it's like, yeah.
You can download it, pre-order it, fucking stream it, whatever the heck it is. But they repeated that a few times, and the room is full of fanboys anyway. I gotta say, the composer of the music.
Oh yeah,
and that music was
brilliant,
great.
Yeah.
In fact, if that music wasn't that good, that movie would not have been that good.
I know.
And oftentimes, it's not the case. You can kind of. You know, sometimes music's just in the background, and if it's serviceable, it's good. But this had such texture to it and such a gritty... This had the grittiness of the book that, you know, we kind of didn't get with maybe the palette or the animation.
Yeah.
You had it there in the music, and it was... the composer talked about using analog synthesizers, and it was something they had actually previously developed, I think, for Year One. But the quality of what he had, they said, was too potent and too 80s and too analog. So they saved it, and then when this project came around, they used the same composer, and they brought back this sound, and he fine-tuned it. And it was really interesting, because at the screening, this was the first time the voice actors, like Peter Weller and everyone else, had seen the movie.
Oh, really?
And right off the bat, Peter Weller's like, who did the music?
And
because he's a jazz musician, this is where it gets funny, is that, you know, Peter Weller, not only an actor, but he's an art history teacher, and he plays in the same band with another eccentric actor.
Dude, he's Buckaroo Banzai.
He's Buckaroo Banzai, but, he plays in the band with, who's the fly?
Jeff
Goldblum.
Jeff Goldblum, yeah.
Right, so those are... That's a very eccentric thing. So it's not like he doesn't know what he's talking about. And luckily, the composer was not on the panel, but he was in the audience, and we did get that background about how it was composed. So it's brilliant. I would buy that soundtrack. I'm gonna try to find it.
There is a company that sells like the soundtracks to those animated releases. So they usually have a booth at Comic-Con. So I'm sure you could find it.
Yeah, brilliant.
If it's not out now, it probably will be. But that's the thing that struck me while I was watching it. That it was the power of the music that really got me involved. And there was a big John Carpenter undertone going on there, and I love, I don't know about you, but I love John Carpenter's 80s movies, like early 80s stuff. The Thing is one of my favorite horror movies of all time. And just that like pounding, like dun-dun-dun, you know what I mean? That sort of, I don't know what you call it, because I'm not a musician, but I was very into that. Very, like I was, and especially when the scenes would get dark and the tension was mounting. The guy, what's his name? God, I wish I had it in front of me. But he did a fantastic job. I mean, whoever composed the music, I mean, the music is a character in the film. Original music by Christopher Drake.
There you go. Yeah.
Christopher Drake, you're a genius, because I feel like the music in this movie, oh, he also did it for Year One.
Yes.
Oh, no, Batman Under the Red Hood. Oh, that's great. So he's done more of these. But whatever, this guy's a genius. And he's done a lot of them. A lot of them.
Yeah.
Emerald Knights, All-Star Superman. Oh, wow. Hellboy animated. He does a lot of stuff like this. Well, whatever. The guy's a genius. And I feel like his music, almost like Gotham City's supposed to be, like in the movies, was a character in the film. Like, I felt like it really, especially if you've got a good surround sound system or you've got headphones on, really surrounded you and enveloped you and was just like dragged you down into the movie. You know what I mean? I was very impressed with that. I think to me that was almost the best aspect of the whole thing, if you want to know the truth. Because like you said, without that music, I don't think this would have been as good.
Oh, no. Yeah, it was
really
absolutely fantastic.
Stuff. Well, I give it thumbs up. I give it a high recommendation. I feel like if you're a fanboy, you got to temper your fanboyishness. Yeah. But, you know, we're part-time fanboys here, so I think that I'm really interested to show it to Amy someday. And maybe when the second part comes in, I'll do that, like, and see what she says and see what she thinks. So, you know, I don't know, but yeah, I mean, those are pretty much my thoughts. You have anything else to say on the Thing?
Or no, I think just really well done, and they did it right, and I will have no problem. I mean, I never even bought Watchmen, but this is something I'm just going to want to have, because I'm glad they got it to do it animated first. I didn't get to ask the question about, you know, how come this hasn't been, you know, has the script been pitched as a full action by the studio, or why is it okay this? That wasn't really addressed because there was limited time in the talk back. But I think those questions will hopefully be answered. But it's nice. It's nice to have it done at this kind of quality. I would love, you know, in imaginary land, I'd love to see a Japanese studio do a version of it.
Yeah.
I think that would be something that would blow people away.
Well, have you seen this Batman?
Yes, I know what you're talking about.
The Gotham Knight.
I love that.
Yeah,
I
that's
love that
brilliant.
Stuff.
That's really good. Really
that
good.
That is some of the best and wackiest Batman stuff.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And that's a beautiful, beautiful piece of work. And that you could see, though, the intensity and focus of that artwork, and it has this the kinetic and frenetic kind of pace. It feels heavy at times. You could really feel weight shifting in that movie. Whereas with this, it's a more American animation style.
Sure, sure.
It really does a great job, though. So I do give it a thumbs up. I agree with you.
Yeah.
And I'm just hoping the next one's as good, if not better. You know, the voice of the Joker is going to be
Ben Linus.
Ben, which I think is great.
Yeah.
There's nothing more I wanted than on Lost for him to be punched in the face.
And
he did get that. It seemed they kicked his ass like every episode. Like, hi, I'm Benjamin Linus. And they just punch him. But you know, he's going to be a great Joker. I think he's going to be great.
Oh, yeah, I think he's going to be good. I think hopefully he pulls it out. It's hard to beat Mark Hamill, but it's really
hard.
Good. Have you seen the Batman Beyond Return of the Joker thing yet?
No.
I'm going
to
get
to borrow that from you.
Yeah, I'm going to get it to you. I got to get it to you next time I see you, which I don't know when that will be. So I have to have like a copy in my pocket at all times.
Yeah.
In my bag. But yeah. Oh, that's awesome. So yeah, this turned out to be really well done. I'm anticipating the second one. I wouldn't say it's the greatest thing I've ever seen, but it's really, really, really solid. So. Yeah, I'm with you. I really enjoyed it. So, all right. Well, this has been another episode of Part Time Fanboy. I'm Christian Horn, and you are
Ian Scheller.
Awesome, and welcome back, Ian. Congratulations.
Thanks,
on the marriage, hope you had a really great time in your honeymoon.
I did.
Cool.
It was fantastic.
All right. Well, then hopefully we'll see you again next week for another one of these.
All right.
All right.
Part-time fanboy doing my thing.
Part-time fanboy.com.